Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you so much for all of your emails. I'm not going to do shout-outs on this edition because I want to get straight into the guest on this edition. Somebody who has a remarkable story that's up there with stories that have been told through history by people like Betty and Barney Hill and Travis Walton. This is the Pascagoula case that you may have been hearing something about recently. Two young men abducted, supposedly by something or someone, and supposedly experimented with. And the story of one of them, Calvin Parker, we're going to unfold to you here. You know, there are various names that are burned into the history of the stuff that we talk about here on The Unexplained, the most famous, of course, being Roswell. But this is one of them. It's Pascagoula. And the year is 1973. We have two men who go through a supposed abduction experience. One of them does not talk about it for a very long time, is traumatized by it, doesn't even talk to his own wife about it, but is now telling a fuller version of the entire story here in a book that you will be able to hear all about on this show. And we'll also put a link to this man, and you'll be able to see all about the book. And if you want to obtain it, you'll be able to do that too. It's all being done through my friend Philip Mantle, well-known British investigator of these things, and Flying Disc Press. So Calvin Parker, the man on this edition of The Unexplained. And of course, people will find it a story that they will either instantly take to and say, totally believable, or they will say whatever they might say. But that's the nature of life, isn't it? You know, there are people who are going to love what I do here, and people who say, oh, terrible interviewer, terrible this, terrible that, and people who are going to love it. You cannot legislate for that. All you can do is do what you do. So Calvin is putting his story out there, and I respect him for it. We'll hear from him in Missouri in just a moment here on The Unexplained. If you'd like to get in touch with me, go to my website, theunexplained.tv. That's theunexplained.tv, designed by Adam from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. It is the official home of The Unexplained, and always has been and always will be. There is a one-stop shop for everything to do with me in this show. And it is the original home of The Unexplained, theunexplained.tv. If you want to send me a message with a guest suggestion, thoughts on the show, whatever, go to the website and you can do it through there. If you'd like to make a donation to allow this free and independent show continue, then you can also do that through the website. And if you have recently, thank you very much indeed. So let's get to the United States now and cross to Calvin Parker. And we'll talk about the Pascagoula incident. Calvin, thank you for coming on my show.
Oh, you're welcome. I'll enjoy it, I'm sure.
You are a bit of a celebrity now, Calvin. I know that everybody wants to interview you. There's a bit of a waiting list to talk with you. The book is doing very well. You're getting a lot of coverage. How does that feel?
Well, actually, I don't like the coverage myself. I wrote the book to get the story out there. Because of such, it was 45 years of silence this coming November, and I felt like it needed to be out because I've never talked about it, not to family, not to friends, not to anyone. So in this way, it feels good, but in another way, you know, it's interrupted my whole life again, and it seemed like this story always comes back to, you know, change things in my life. I went from not wanting any media attention to getting more media attention than I wanted. And that's good, being we got the book out there.
Well, it is good, especially as the fact of the matter is it's better to hear the story from the person, him or herself, involved in this, rather than some future researcher, maybe in 30 years from now, try to look back at this incident, go back through newspaper archives, you know, try and find out something about it, and simply not being able to get a first-hand account. So even though it may be painful at times to be pursued by the media and, you know, constantly being asked the same questions over and over again, hopefully in a different way, you know, it's better that you tell it, isn't it?
It is a lot better in... Who else knows the story any better than what I do?
It's an extraordinary story. I know and have interviewed people like Travis Walton before, and the first thing that I thought, and we'll get into the specifics of the case, of course we will, but the first thing I thought is that, you know, in some ways, you have an awful lot in common with Travis Walton, if you know him.
Yes, sir, I've met Travis one time, and this was a long time ago. This is right when his experience first happened. But, you know, we hadn't stayed in touch or anything. The only thing I know, he's from Snowflake, Arizona, and he goes to all the conferences here.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that you haven't over these 40-odd years done. All right, well, I think we have to get into the story. It is, in some ways, a classic alien abduction story, and in other ways, it certainly ain't. So talk to me about what happened on October the 11th, 1973, when you were 19.
Yes, sir. I had made it to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and actually it was my first day at work at the Shaw Peters Shipyard. So after getting off, a friend of mine, Charles Hickson, and myself decided to go fishing because it was really hot down here that day, and we wanted to kind of cool down, fish a little bit before we went home to eat and took a shower. So we got our fishing equipment, and we went to an old abandoned shipyard where it used to be a grain elevator where they unloaded these ships. And the grain would fall off, and the fish would come up inside, and they would eat the grain. And there was plenty of fish there, what he said. Now, I'd never fished there. So we drove to the old Shaw Peters shipyard, which was an abandoned shipyard. And when we drove up, I noticed there was no trespassing sign, but it was a lot of debris laying out on the ground where that had floated up. And he explained to me, I thought there was just messy people there, but the river gets up and it brought in all this old debris that floated in, and it wouldn't go out when the water went down. So we parked, and that made us have to park a pretty good ways from where we fished, probably the length of a football field. And we wrestled to get down to where the pier was, where we was going to fish. And it was an old steel pier, and it was on the water, and the shipyard was abandoned then. So got ready, and we got our stuff out, got to fishing. And I was looking across the river, and I noticed some blue hazy lights coming in from behind me that was reflected on the water and the bank across the river. And I thought, well, what's wrong now? And the first thing that came to my mind, we was on private property, no trespassing sign. And the local authorities, the police down here, have blue hazy lights on their cars. And I figured they was down there to make us move.
Right, so you thought the cops had got onto you and they just come to tell you to go.
Right, and that's really what I thought. I didn't expect nothing else. So I was facing the river, and the lights was coming behind me, so that means that this was all happening on the land about where we was parked. I turned around and looked, and instantly, by the time I got turned around, there was a bright light. It was so bright, it was blinding. I mean, you just had to close your eyes for a second to keep from, so you can see. And it take just a minute for your eyes to adjust. Well, the time my eyes was adjusting, well, Charlie had done turned around then, we seen something, three bulky figures coming toward us. And we still, at this time, or I still didn't know what it was, but it was kind of scary. But they was moving so fast, you knew it wasn't humanly possible for them to move across. And the reason I talked about the debris, because of the debris that you had to come across to get in, it was humanly impossible for them to move that fast across all that marsh grass and debris that was in place.
And you said three bulky figures. Describe them. Were they tall? Were they short and wide? You know, how were they bulky?
Well, from the time that we seen them, you know, you couldn't really make out any details. But when they got on us, and two of them got a hold of Charlie, one got a hold of myself, they was probably four and a half, maybe 5 foot tall at the most. Mm-hmm. They had kind of grayish skin, and it was wrinkled kind of like an elephant or maybe a manatee, if you've seen a manatee before. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of that color. And now I don't know the texture of the skin because I never really felt the skin. But it scared us so bad, you know, I was thinking about running, but it was so fast, there was nowhere to run.
And were they, obviously, you said they grabbed you. It was a violent act. Were they strong?
this one that got a hold of me was strong because, you know, he grabbed me by the arm and I instantly, well, I got relaxed when he grabbed me because I felt like a little puncture in my arm. So I'm assuming they might have gave me some kind of tranquilizer or something to settle me down. I'm not for sure about that, but I assume that. But we automatically come up a couple of foot off the ground. So yes, sir, they had to be pretty strong or they had something in their favor making them strong.
Okay, so in the space of seconds, literally, these things had appeared, they grabbed hold of you and lifted you off the ground. And you were starting to feel, because of their appearance, because of the look of their skin and everything else, that these things were in some way not human. Had anything in your experience up to that date prepared you for that?
No, sir. No, sir, not a thing. And at the moment, you know, you're so scared and everything, you don't realize really what's going on. All you know is something violently is coming after you. You don't know what it is, and you have no clue of what's fixing to happen. And you kind of get worried. But then immediately when they picked you up, you know, you kind of felt that little injection, and the fear is gone. But you can't move. You're just laying in one position, and you're looking straight ahead. Now, I couldn't turn my head left or right. I couldn't move nothing.
And what was happening to Charlie Hickson?
I don't know. I didn't see him no more after that. I tried to look out of the corners of my eyes, you know, roll my eyes to each side and look, because I was conscious, and I could move my eyes, but I couldn't turn my head to look to see what happened to him. I'm assuming that he went on, you know, went in the same direction I did, that he went inside that craft. And they took us to the, when this one picked me up, he floated us toward that bright light. And still at this time, I couldn't tell what the bright light consists of. I just knew it was a bright light there. And it didn't take, but just shortly, we was at that light. And I could see then it was like a door or a passage open inside this craft.
So did you feel you'd been like I'm sorry to interrupt because it's such a compelling story, but did you feel, Calvin, that you'd been sort of levitated upwards? Is that what happened?
That's exactly what happened. And we floated across the top of that marsh grass and debris, so we didn't have to walk through it. And they was also floating with us, so we was actually levitated right along up with them and floated to the craft. And that's what made it real quick, you know, to get back to it instead of having to walk through all that mess.
So you were taken up to a door. The door, yes. To what? What were you being taken up to?
It looked like a door, and you could see on the inside. And the first thing I was trying to figure out is where all these lights was coming from. But when I looked on the inside, I didn't see any lights. It looked like the walls was illuminating the lights out. And when we went inside, you know, they were still just real bright, but my eyes was getting kind of used to it then. And they kind of made a little left turn and then a right turn, and they took me into I call it an examination room. I guess that's what it was.
They were carrying you at that time, or were you floating through this craft?
I was just kind of floating through the craft still. And when I went into this examination room, they laid me on my back. So I don't know if I was laying on a table or maybe air or just what I was laying on, but it had to be something there. And they kind of laid me at a 45-degree angle, and I was looking up at the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And out of the ceiling came about the size of a deck of cards, and it come down about 2 foot in front of my eyes, a foot and a half, 2 foot. And you could hear it click. It went click when it got between my eyes. On the side of my head, it clicked again. Then on the back, it did that 4 times. And then it went straight back up into the ceiling.
So today, obviously, I mean, this was 45 years ago, but today we've got technology a little like that. It does dental scans and all sorts of things. So were you, this is all before that technology existed. You say that you were tranquilized, but you must have been thinking because you were taking it in. Did you think that you were being scanned? Did you think, geez, they're going to kill me? What were you thinking?
Well, see, being from the being young in front of the country and never really being to a doctor or a hospital and having much done, you really didn't know. But if I could think back, you know, I would think it was like an MRI, because I've had one since then. Hmm. And you could hear it, the noise was the same. And when I did that, it made me remember. I kind of had a flashback to then. I said, you know, they had this, probably had this technology, a lot better technology, because it's not as big. Hmm. And they probably doing the same thing back then that's happening to me now. And, you know, they hadn't been out too long with them MRI deals.
So you're lying there at 45-degree angle. You're looking up at the ceiling. What about the creatures? Are you seeing them? And if you are they communicating with you?
Well, the one that brought me into the craft, he was moved kind of mechanically and all. You know, and I think it was more like a soldier to them or a robot, because you could tell by the way that he moved that it wasn't like human-like movements. And he had backed away. And then when this scan got through with me, there's a different creature come in. It was more of a human-looking creature, except, you know, without the same features that we have. And I call it a female because it was feminine-looking. Mm. Now, she come in with kind of the human features, and you could tell she had hands and fingers and facial features, kind of like a human in a way, but just a different type skin. And I thought, well, that's strange. But if you think about it, on Earth here today, you know, we got people that has different color skins and different types and different hair and things like that, and that's nothing unusual here.
But so, you were kind of getting the thought that there was some kind of hierarchy that you were dealing with, were you?
I did. And I felt like maybe she was like a doctor examining, going to examine me or something. And she did do kind of what I call a simple examination. She took her fingers, and I didn't feel any texture when they touched, because I was wondering, you know, you couldn't feel nothing when she grabbed you by the cheeks and mouth. And she put her finger down my throat and kind of curved it up into my nasal cavity a little bit, because I felt myself gagging. And took it out, and she looked up my nose and all, and just looked. And that was kind of scary to me, because I didn't know what was fixing to happen. So when the fear factor started coming back, her mouth didn't move, but I could hear her talking, and it was English, just as plain as what it would be if she had said it. And she said, don't worry, we're not going to harm you. Have no fear, we're not going to harm you.
Well, of course, you know, but if you watch the movies, sometimes the bad guys in movies, and sometimes if it's science fiction, they say those things, and they maybe don't mean it. But were you convinced by this supposedly telepathic message that you were getting? Did you think that she meant what she said?
I did. For some reason, you know, it calmed me down again. And, you know, it's hard to stay calm when you've been abducted.
And that's, absolutely.
That's the same thing as if you're sitting in your house watching TV or something, somebody kicks a door in and come get you and takes you out to a van and gives you a physical examination and all. That's the same thing. That's an invasion. That's an abduction.
And whether it happens on a back street here or whether it happens, you know, somewhere above this planet, and we'll get to find out whether you had any idea of where you were, you know, relative to Earth at that point. But you would be asking the same questions wherever it happened. You would be saying, what are you doing? Why am I here? Why me?
Exactly right. And it's a scary situation. And anybody said it wouldn't scare them, they lying. They, you know, they have to be. Either that or they just don't care about life, one. And me being young and all, you know, it probably put a little extra fear into you.
And were you able to open your mouth and speak and ask those questions?
No. All I could do was roll my eyes. My brain seemed to be working good, you know, because I was thinking and I was kind of looking around, and I could hear. And when she kind of backed off, she made like a mumble, but her mouth didn't move. I rolled my eyes to look, and that's when the old big ugly thing that I call the big ugly, when the soldier came back in, and it was just kind of four little mumble words that I couldn't make out. Mm. And he came back in and grabbed me by the arm again, and it, you know, I guess like the tranquilizer again, it just relaxed me again.
So this soldier was one of the, was certainly similar to the original creatures that took you away, the 5 foot tall, you know, stocky build kind of thing.
Yes, sir. I think it was the same one. They all looked the same. All three of them looked the same when they was coming to us on the outside.
And in terms of physical features, these creatures, you know, were they recognizable as maybe humanoid in some way, maybe related to us? Did they have any similarities to us? You talked about the doctor that you was aware that she was giving you a message, but you didn't see her mouth move.
Right. Now, the big ugly ones didn't resemble nothing that I've ever seen, but she could possibly... or it could possibly be, you know, resemble some kind of human. But as I said before, you know, there's different races, there's different color of people, there's different habits, different religions. So, you know, it could have possibly been some kind, but it was different than what I was used to. It wasn't redneck doctor.
And outside science fiction books and obscure ones at that, people weren't really talking about hybrids. They were barely talking about alien cases in those days, although it was 1973 and there was more of that stuff about. And we'd had TV series like The Invaders, which I, you know, loved on television on. So people were sort of prepared for these sorts of things. Now, you were told no harm will come to you. Relax. Which, you know, what else could you do but comply in that situation?
Yeah.
But they didn't tell you what they wanted you for, it seems.
They didn't. And I feel like today, looking back on it, I feel like maybe I was some kind of experiment to them. You know how, which is wrong, but the human race experiments with animals for different reasons, and they call it medical experiments. I think that's probably about what was going on back then, except with humans. And like I say, it's wrong. I don't feel like anybody should experiment with animals or humans or anything.
So you were scanned. The female doctor checked out your nasal cavities. Was anything else done? You know, in previous abduction cases like Betty and Barney Hill, we hear about people being probed in various ways. Were you aware that anything was done to you? Was anything, you know, pushed into you? Were you cut in any way? Did anything like that happen, Calvin?
The only puncture mark I remember having, and when I went to the hospital the next day, was on my arm where that one had grabbed me. And when they did grab me, I did hear like a puff of air come out, you know, and that was when this first happened. So that's the only one I know of. But, you know, if it was, they hit it well, you know, it might have been something else.
Could you give any description of the craft that you felt you were on and what, you know, location that craft may have been in? Was it floating above where you left from? Was it high above Earth? Was it millions of miles away? Did you get any sense of any of that?
Well, when we was approaching it, the lights were so bright it was hard to say. But it kind of seemed like it was hovering a couple of foot off the ground according to the marsh grass that we was looking at. And I don't feel like it had no legs or nothing under it. I think it was just kind of stable there. And
there wouldn't have been anybody else if it was happening close relative to the ground in the place you were abducted from. There wouldn't have been anybody else, you know, within a mile or two of there who might have seen something?
Yes, sir. It was people that did see something. They come forward and it got put into Charlie's book when they came forward and all, and I hadn't read it yet, but they were eyewitness accounts, and they still coming forward till today, and they're real believable because they described it. Now, there was a guy on the bridge. They had a bridge there that they would lift to let the big ships on in and out, or the boats in and out. It wasn't a tow bridge, but the sheriff department went to investigate him to see if he'd seen anything. And when they got there, he was sitting with his back to the river in a recliner, leaned back asleep, and he'd wait on somebody to call on a radio before he opened the bridge. So, you know, that kind of done away with the theory he might have seen something.
Right, so that guy slept through it all. Okay, so we'd left the story, hadn't we, where you were being observed and prodded and all the rest of it. You didn't know where Charlie Hixon was at that point. They told you they didn't want to hurt you. What happened then? Did they show you the craft? Did they explain anything to you? Or did they just simply put you straight back from where you came?
They carried me out the door and put me back at the river, facing the river. I remember my arms being stretched out because I could see the end of my fingers from where I was standing on the river. And then that's when I heard from Charlie. Charlie said, Calvin, you okay, son? And I come to, and the time I turned around and looked, they was headed back to the craft. And we was both turned around looking in. And the bright lights went out, so that I figured they must have closed the door. And this thing picked up off the ground just a little bit, and then it just like disappeared up into the air like a streak of lightning. It was just that fast. You could hear a little zipping noise, and it was gone.
So the craft shot into space, you think?
It did, yes, wow. Sir.
Now look, something like that happening to you and Charlie is traumatic enough. God knows how somebody young, but how anybody would handle that. But to have that happen to you, and in those minutes after you get put back, not only do you not know quite what's happened, but you've got no idea why. That must have left your head in turmoil.
It did, and I just got to where I couldn't deal with it. Charlie and I sat down on that pier afterwards. He said, sit down, let's talk about this for a minute, cool down. They're gone, you know. We lived through it, they're gone. So we sat down on the pier, and I said, Charlie, let's not tell nobody. This didn't happen. I don't want to talk to nobody about it. I want to get up and go to work in the morning and forget all about this. Charlie said, well, how do you not talk to somebody about it? He said, I've got to call Keesler. He said, the human race might be in danger, and I need to let somebody know. I said, Charlie, this didn't happen. I didn't see nothing. So we had a bit of a little argument there about all of it.
And who was Charlie wanting to tell? Who was he wanting to report it to?
He wanted to call Keesler Air Force Base. Mm. The Air Force Base was probably 15 miles from where this happened. So he wanted to call Keesler at the time and talk to them. And I was totally against all this. I just wanted to put it in the back of my mind and forget it and be done with it.
And did you tell him that if he was going to do that, you would deny it?
No, I didn't tell him I'd deny it. I just told him I wasn't going to talk about it. And he said, well, you don't have to. We'll make up some story for you where you don't have to talk about it. So then he said, you know, that would be it. So we did. We got back in the car, and we drove to a little convenience store. At the time, you know, it was no cell phones or computers or anything like that. And in the state of Mississippi during this time, they had what they call blue laws. So you couldn't really sell anything after a certain time of the day. And the whole town was shut down. So, you know, there wasn't nothing really open. So the phones was on the outside of the stores, and we just pulled the car up, store. We pulled the car up, and he got out and went and called Keesler on the phone, Keesler Air Force Base, and they told him he explained to him what happened, and they said, we don't deal with things like this anymore, or neither have we ever. You need to call your local sheriff department or local authorities. So that's when Charlie called the local sheriff department. It took the local sheriff department not about 10 minutes probably to get out to where we were. And they come driving up. One got out, come on my side of the car. One went on Charlie's side of the car, and they just looked in. they asked me to step out, and they gave me a what you call a field sobriety test, just to check us to see if we was drinking.
Right, so they had to rule out whether you were on something or you'd been on the booze.
Exactly right, and that's the first thing they did. So they gave me their little sobriety test. We took it, then they told us to follow them to the sheriff department. So if we'd been intoxicated or anything, or inebriated at the time, we would have rode in the back seat of the patrol car with them. So they let us follow them on to the sheriff department. And that's when they took us in separate rooms. They interrogated Charlie in one room, interrogated myself in the other. And I just stayed with the story. Look, I don't know what happened. I must have passed out or something. I don't know what's going on, because I didn't want to talk about it. Then they put us in the same room in there, and that's where I messed up talking about it to Charlie. We was in there together, so we started having a conversation about how scared and all we were. And, you know, that's when they knew that we was both there.
Hmm. And in a way, by inadvertently having that conversation, you were corroborating your story, because you weren't going to talk like that between you if nothing had happened.
Exactly right. You know, so that gave them the I told them that we was together and something had happened. They didn't know what at the time. So they, when they got us out of that room, when they put us in there together and we talked about it, we didn't know there was a tape recorder in the room. And one of the deputies, detectives, come in there and they got the tape recorder out of the drawer. We still didn't know what it was. And they went in there, all of them together, for a while. And by that time, the sheriff showed up, which was Fred Diamond. And they listened to it. And he come back in. He said, y'all go home. And we need you. We'll get you. And they got the address where we live. We need you. We'll come see you. And I said, Sheriff Diamond, I don't want nobody to know about this. Please don't mention it, nobody. He said, well, we're not in that kind of business. We're not the media. We're here to enforce the law and things. So we're not going to tell nobody. Don't worry about it. So we went home, and I remember on the way home, me being worried about contamination of some kind to diseases or maybe radiation or something, because in the back of my mind, I knew something happened. And I knew it was something to worry about.
Now, why would you be thinking that way? If you were going through the initial trauma of having been abducted, I guess your first feelings would be about, you know, did they hurt me? What on earth was this? But your mind leapt ahead to possible contamination. You know, that was quite a forward-thinking way to be considering this.
It was. And it's like going into any other country or something. You know, they worry about you taking a disease to them or them bringing one to you, and they vaccinate you and do different things. So that, I don't know why it even crossed my mind.
Did you feel okay?
I felt good, yeah, because I was out of there alive, and that's the reason I felt pretty good about it. Now, why I was worried about all that or why I even thought about it, I don't know. But I guess in certain circumstances, you start thinking of everything that could happen or did happen or that might would happen. And that was the case here. So when we got home, I remember there was a paper bag in my room back in. You know, you didn't have real garbage bags or you couldn't afford them. So I took all my clothes off. I went to my room, took all my clothes off, including my shoes and everything, put them in the bag, and went into the bathroom, and there was some bleach in there, and I poured bleach on me, and I washed myself with bleach. And when I got out, I took my clothes and put them in the inside the garbage bag and took outside to the dumpster. So, you know, like I say, I was real worried about contamination and
yet,
for some reason.
And yet, if you had, if you'd wanted to, if you wanted to have some evidence there in case anybody questioned you about this in the future, because you'd kind of let the cat out of the bag when you were with the police and you'd corroborated Charlie's story. So you both had the same story. Why didn't you keep the clothes? If you kept them in a bag, they would have been some evidence.
Well, if you think back, I was still just a kid. I wasn't thinking about evidence or nothing, because I didn't know how anything like that worked. I was a country boy, you know. We was brought up plowing gardens, planting, and working hard from daylight to dark, and no education. I didn't have any education, still don't. So, you know, we didn't think ahead in terms like that. We didn't think of guilty and innocent and evidence and things.
You just wanted to get the experience behind you.
I just wanted to get rid of everything, and thinking today, I wish I had kept them, because it could have been some kind of DNA or something on my clothing.
And of course, we know an awful lot more about those things today, but you know, you were young, you've been through something that sounds horrendous, and there'd be more questions in your head than answers. After that, and it's quite common, did you have what we would call today the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder? Were you having nightmares, that kind of thing?
Well, I've done that for 45 years, and I wouldn't call it really post-traumatic stress, but you know, it's not a day that don't go by that you don't think about this and wonder what happened, because it's still, even to this day, even after the book, to me, it's still unknown. Why? And what did they want? Why are they doing it? Are they going to even come back one day? And, you know, so it's still a lot of unanswered questions there.
So how did you, if you did, get on with your normal life after that?
Well, after that, it was not a normal life. We got up the next day and went back to work. And of course, it was a media frenzy where we was working. They called us into the office. They said, look, we got an attorney headed here for a press release, but we cannot conduct business in this office because we can't even get on the telephones. They're not functional. People out where y'all working is going to ask questions when this gets around. It's going to take away from work. So y'all need to take a few days off and all. So they called in their attorney, the shipyard's attorney, to handle a press release. And he came in and he talked to the press. And we still didn't know how this word got out or what they was even talking about. But it was big media back then. It was press all over the world that had come in.
How did the media get to know about this?
That was my question, exactly. Because back then, unless somebody called and told them, or they had scanners. Back then, everybody had a scanner.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, because that was the only hobby people had, was being nosy. And, you know, they would scan the police departments and the fire departments, things like that.
Right. So if there was any traffic going on there, sorry to interrupt, but I guess, you know, newspaper offices, you're reminding me now, when I started work in Liverpool, we had, they were illegal here, but we had one, and you could listen into the police communications. So if there were emergency service communications around that time, maybe somebody in some newspaper office there locally heard it. And once that happens, the cat is out of the bag, because they start phoning other people, and then the whole world's on your doorstep.
Right. And newspaper office was within a city block of the sheriff department then. So, you know, when they picked it up, I'm sure they had reporters run over there and talk to them. And after it goes out on that scanner, you know, the sheriff department would have to talk to them and tell them about it or deny it. So, you know, that's probably how the story got started. I'm not for sure to this day.
But did I get this right? Tell me if I did, Calvin. That there you are at work, and they say, you know, the whole media's here. They all want to know about this this weird story. We think you guys ought to take a couple of days off. And they put a statement out on your behalf. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, sir. The shipyard did. And the reason for that was to try to get the media to quit calling the shipyard and interfering with their daily activities.
Well, you know, the media, that's not going to stop anybody.
No, why? And it went on. It still goes on till this day. I mean, the best thing you can do is something like that happens is just go to the media and tell them about it. If they find out, you know, and talk to them and try to get it over with, maybe it'll last a few minutes and it'll be over with.
Of course, these days they probably pay you $200,000 for your story, I guess, as well. So, but your employers put out a statement on your behalf. Two questions that come from that. What did that statement say? And yes, you were young, but how did you feel about having somebody else speak for you about something that had happened to you and not them?
Well, I didn't want to talk to nobody about it because I still had put it in my mind that I wasn't going to tell nobody. I knew the word was out, and I have no clue what they had, the shipyard had released. I let Charlie kind of back up and handle everything. He was a little older, and he didn't seem to mind talking about it, not then and not up till the day he died. So I pretty much just let him handle the press. And even till today, I don't like really talking about it. And when I did this book, I didn't want to do the book, but I felt like I owed it to the people, to my family and friends, because up until this book came out, just before the book came out, I never talked to my wife about it, you know, so.
Really?
It's something I didn't want to talk about.
Calvin, that's an awful lot to live with, to carry around on your shoulders for an awful lot of years. That's been hard to get through then.
Oh, it was tough. I had a good friend. I was sitting there talking to him just shortly after the book come out, and he didn't know I was even writing a book. And he said, "Where have you been?" Because normally, you know, we'd get out and visit and I'd go around, but I locked myself away for a little while just to do this book. And I says, "Well, I've been writing a book." Of course, he might have had an idea of what I was writing it on because my wife might have let it slip to him, you know, that I was writing a book on this experience here. He said, "You know, we've sat around and told each other many lies, but you never lied to me about this because you never talked to me about it." I said, "Well, and guess what? I'm not going to talk to you now about it. If you want to hear about it, you buy the book and read about it. Or if you can't afford it, he can't afford it. I said, I'll buy it for you and you read it. But I'm not going to sit down and talk to you about it." So that's why in the book, I put it in my words. I didn't want them changed. And, you know, it might not be proper. I didn't have a major in literature or nothing, but I have to give Philip credit for one thing. He ain't changed nothing in the book, not the way I talk, not the things I say, not even much as my spelling, but that was part of the deal we had.
This is Philip Mantle, UK UFO investigator.
Yes, sir, Philip Mantle, and he has been great to work with.
Yeah, he's a friend of this show and a good guy. If you were going to work with anybody, I can't think of anybody better.
Oh, I can't either. Philip Mantle has been a great person to work with, and he did just exactly what he said. Matter of fact, I wouldn't even wrote the book if it hadn't been for him. My wife and I was at a wake, and at this wake, I signed a register, you know, just I don't know why, but it was there, and I just signed that book. So people started recognizing the signature. Now, who had ever thought that people would have recognized this? But this is people that came in from Texas and everywhere, and they started asking me questions. I didn't want to take away from this family's grieving or anything, so I told my wife, I said, "Let's go." We got in a car and we was driving off. She said, "You know, everybody wants to hear about this. You need to write a book. You need to tell people." I said, "Look, I'm not educated. I don't have a major in literature or anything. I have no idea how to write a book or what to say in one." I said, "I don't even know where to put the periods at the end of a sentence." And I said, "If I get a ghostwriter one day that knows how to write, I might let them do it." And I figured it'd be dropped in.
But in the meantime, over the years, if I've got this right, Charlie was telling the story. Now, what we know about traumas when, you know, people die, sometimes families split up, there are divisions. Sometimes people who go through accidents or terrorist incidents and things like that, it changes them. it changes them irrevocably, and sometimes friends get distant and stuff like that. How have you got on with Charlie, and how, if at all, does his account of this differ from yours? Are you both telling exactly the same tale?
You know, I don't know, because after this happened, a few days after this happened, I left the coast down here, and I would periodically see Charlie. He would come back home to Sandersville or Laurel, and I'd see him, but we never talked about this. I had a copy of his book. Matter of fact, Philip Mantle sent me a copy of his book. I never read his book. Didn't care to know, didn't want to know. And I completely separated him from myself.
Do you still count him as a friend, or is he not that now?
No, he never was a friend. He was a friend of my father's. Mm. Charlie was a good deal older than I was. Mm. Now, I was friends with his kids, with his children, was raised with them. But when I went to work for Charlie, he was a friend of my father's, and I was needing a job. So I called him up, and he told me to come and go to work. Now, I liked Charlie, and Charlie was a good man. But you know, as far as friendship, we never were friends. And to be honest with you, when Charlie passed away a few years ago, I never even knew he died until I wrote the book. And Philip said, well, you know, Charlie died here. I said, well, no, I really didn't know Charlie had died.
And did that help you make the decision to get your story out?
Not at all. What made me get my story out was at the funeral. My wife talked to me. She said, I'd never heard. You never told us. We never talked about it. And then why don't you write a book and tell your friends and your family? Well, when I got home 2 or 3 days later, Philip had been hunting me on a project that he had going on about Charlie's book. And I said, well, you know, I'm really not interested. I signed an agreement with Charlie to get a certain percentage of his book when it was written, but I've never seen a penny out of it. He, you know, he breached the contract there, but I didn't want one out of it. And he says, well, I said, I don't give interviews to the press and all because they change his story. He said, look, Calvin, he said, why don't you write your own book? You get it in writing, you document it. He said, that's your legacy, and then nobody can change it. It's all black and white. It's right there. And that sounded good to me, so that's when I decided. I thought about it. You can ask Philip. It took me probably 3 weeks to decide to go with it.
Some people who get abducted, they have ongoing experiences. But by the sounds of this, you wanted to put this behind you, and nothing else happened after that. So all you've had is this period of 45 years where you've had to come to terms with the one event. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Now, I did have some missing time in 93, and I did go see Bud Hopkins. I'm not for sure you're familiar with Bud
Hopkins. I am very familiar with Bud Hopkins, yeah.
But I went in 93 to see Bud Hopkins. I had been fishing one day, and about 11 o'clock that day, I was supposed to be home before dark, and it got dark in about 4 o'clock. And the next thing I knew, it was 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and all that span of time was missing in there. So a friend of mine was down. He said, well, I know a guy that wrote a book on missing time, and he said, that's what you got is some missing time. He said, why don't we go see him? So we drove to Florida. Bud was doing a conference in Florida, and I said, now, I don't want to go in and be seen. I don't want nobody to see me because I don't want to hear about UFOs or aliens or talk about them. I said, so if I go in there, I could be recognized, you know, because the press still takes pictures and all. Would you go in and talk to Bud and tell him I want to see him? And I didn't know Bud from anybody then. He said, I will. So he went in and talked to Bud, and Bud told him, well, yeah, I want to see him. I'll be through here in about an hour. Y'all go to my room and wait on me there. So Bud gave us a key to his room, and we went over to his room, and sure enough, he showed up in about an hour, hour and a half. And we sat down and talked, and Bud made me feel real comfortable around him. And he said, well, would you give me permission to hypnotize you? I said, well, I don't think I can be hypnotized. But if you want to, yeah, go ahead and try it. He said, I think I could really help you come to terms with everything if you do. So that was the one word that I heard. So this friend of mine, I said, do me a favor. You stay in the room and you keep this stuff legitimate. And, you know, I've been to shows where they say they hypnotize the whole audience and they get up and make them do stupid stuff. I said, I don't want no memories put in my brain that's not already there. So that friend of mine said, okay. Of course, I didn't think Bud would do it, but, I didn't know Bud then. So we underwent a hypnosis session, and it must have been a few hours, several hours of it. And I didn't realize I had ever been hypnotized until Philip Mantle got his hands on the original tape that Bud Hopkins made. And the way that he knew it, I said, he had mentioned Bud Hopkins one time, because I was telling him I had some missing time and I went to see Bud Hopkins. Oh, and he said, I know Bud, and Bud's a good friend of mine, or was. And he said, he passed away. Well, I didn't know Bud had passed away. He said, well, what happened? I said, well, he tried to hypnotize me. And that's all I said. And the next thing I knew, Philip was calling Dr. Jacobs.
David Jacobs. Is that David Jacobs?
David Jacobs, right. To get a transcript of the tapes.
And you'd never seen the transcripts and you'd never heard the tapes?
Never heard them, never seen them. Matter of fact, when he got the tapes, he transcribed it on paper and then he made a copy and a CD and sent it to me. But when he transcribed it and sent it over to the computer, I couldn't believe that was me. I had no idea I had been hypnotized, but it was. I mean, my voice, it was black and white, and it then I started remembering what was on there, and
I'm sorry to interrupt here. forgive me for this, but when you were with Bud Hopkins and you had that session, you really didn't ask afterwards when you came out of it what happened.
No, sir.
You didn't.
I didn't want to know, and Bud knew I didn't want to know. He put a post-hypnotic suggestion in my head that I could remember this as I could handle it, because he didn't feel like I could handle everything that went on.
I get it.
At the time.
So was this specifically about the missing time in 1993, strangely enough, 20 years after the original incident? Is that what this was about?
It was about the missing time, plus it was about what had happened on 73. So both encounters were in there. It started out in October 1973, and it was so thorough that there was a car out there that I recognized a car when Charlie and I pulled in. You know, I seen one parked over there. But you don't think about something like that when you're going fishing but it was so thorough that I recognized the tag number and I was able to call the tag number out on the car and we verified the tag number now, just not too long ago.
Whose car was it?
Well, I can't say because I promised the people I wouldn't, but I went and talked to one of the ladies was still alive. It was a couple. They was there parking, and this couple had got married, and he had recently passed away a few years ago, and now she is in a nursing home and has a little bit of Alzheimer's, but still remembers. But she remembers that, remembers it pretty well.
So under hypnosis, you were able to recall witnesses to the original event?
Exactly right. And that didn't help nothing but me. I mean, I was able to go talk to these people. And they had seen the craft. I don't think they seen us when we went aboard, but it scared them so bad they left. And
she is still in a care home now.
She is. And she don't want to be known or nobody know where she is. And I respect her feelings on that because that was the way I felt. And like I say, they got married. They was out there. People didn't have money for motels or nowhere to go. So back in, they just get in their car and do whatever they needed to do. And that was the case there.
Okay, so you had some witnesses you didn't even know about. Did you recall any more details about the original abduction and the missing time? We haven't really talked about the specifics of that.
The original abduction, I really I hadn't really read the transcripts or nothing on it, but I started remembering some on the missing time. And I remember, and this might be in the original abduction, I'm not for sure. I hadn't got into this tape, but I remember them coming, me being on board the ship, and her taking her finger and running up in my nasal cavity, and I started bleeding. And we actually got into a physical confrontation with the female-looking object, because I was in such pain and I was really hurting that I grabbed her and I slammed her head against the wall before the big ugly one came back in to get me. And I remember blood, my blood and her blood. So, you know, and I remember being bloody, you know, and that might be why I was worried about being contaminated.
Right, and you didn't know any of this when you were returned in 1973 to where you'd started from. This all came out under hypnosis.
It did, yes, sir. I remember the abduction and all, but, you know, there's a lot more that hypnosis said than what I originally put out.
Okay, and now, so did you get a clue as to what they wanted with you, more details about the ship when you'd been hypnotized?
I didn't. I've got this book out there, and the whole transcripts are in the book, but I've never sat down and read it. I don't want to read it because I don't want to remember that part myself.
You know something? I completely understand you. I have a feeling. I don't know, really. I might look at it if it was me, but if it was so traumatic and I really didn't want to go back there, I'm not sure if I would be able to go back. So I get what you're saying, Calvin. The missing time, though, it must have struck you as being odd that you had missing time. And again, we haven't talked about the circumstances of that, where you were, for example, but it was 20 years. It was a 20-year anniversary, almost.
Yes, sir. And it was, I was actually fishing. I had got in my boat and left that morning going to a little island to do some fishing. And I was supposed to be back before nighttime, or she was going to call the Coast Guard, but I didn't show up before the next morning. So everybody was starting to get worried, and she was going to call the Coast Guard the next morning to have them go hunt me. And I wish she had called them at night. Maybe they could have found my boat and seen what was going on. I don't know. And like I say, for some reason, I can't bring myself to read all that. And I have a copy off the original tape of the CD here in my voice, and I can't bring myself to listen to that. It's just something, you know. And if anybody has the book and they want to go back and read it in the Bud Hopkins hypnosis session, they're welcome to do it, but I'm not going to.
And yet, even doing this interview and all the other interviews that you're doing will be having the same effect, won't it? It'll be prodding at that hornet's nest again.
Yes, sir. It does. And and sometimes it's really hard to sit down and talk about it. It's harder sometimes than other times. And, you know, I find myself choking up a little bit sometimes. But, you know, it's getting easier and easier. And one of the best things to happen to me is Philip, you know, getting me to bring this out. And that way maybe I can deal with it a little better.
Do you have kids?
Yes, sir. I have a daughter.
Right. So you have a daughter, you have a wife?
And I had a son that passed away.
I'm sorry.
When he was 22 years old.
Oh, I'm
so.
Sorry. But you have a family. Has it changed your relationship with your wife and with your daughter? Do they think differently about you now that they know the full strength of all of this?
Well, I really can't say that it changed anything. You know, we're still a tight-knit family, and we all care and love for each other and there for each other. But, you know, I don't talk to them anymore. I still hadn't talked to them about this. They asked me a question, and if I can answer it, easy answer for them. Now, my wife started reading this book, and she can't get through it, especially the hypnosis session with Bud Hopkins, she starts crying. She just throws the book down. And I'm not sure my daughter's ever tried to read any of the book or not. She has one, but I'm not for sure how much of it she's read.
And when stuff comes on the TV, when you start seeing dramas on the TV about We Are Not Alone, and the latest reports from Mars suggesting there might be life on Mars, has what you've been through, and now what you know fully what you've been through, you think, has that affected the way you consider those things now?
Yeah, because I got a genuine interest in them. You know, I want to learn. I want to watch everything I can. And I want to see just what turns up in the future. Who knows what the future holds for anybody? And it's got to hold something.
Of course, all the way through this, we've sort of assumed, because people do, that these are space aliens. We don't actually know that, do we? We don't know where they came from, whether it was another dimension, whether it was something that's here already but is being kept secret, or whether it's from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, nobody can say for sure because nobody knows. If it ever happens to me again, I'm going to try my best to catch one of them and, you know, maybe ask a few questions. But I've got a feeling that that's not going to happen, that nobody's ever going to catch one because they seem to be a little smarter than we are. But I think they come from travel, interdimensional. And I just can't help but believe that. I've been sitting in rooms sometime, and out of the corner of my eye, I see something that looks like it's passed by. And, you know, you let your mind wander sometime about different things like that. So, but that would be a way they could travel and get around.
So whatever it is, it's possibly here with us all the time. We just simply, most of the time, don't see it.
That's what I think. That's the way that I really believe. Now, you know, it's kind of like believing in God. You know God's there, or I do, and I believe in God, and there's no doubt in my mind about it. But as far as physically seeing him, you know, I don't think you could physically see him, but you could see what he does all over the world, you know. You could see the change of the seasons. You can see the stars. You can see the trees. You can see everything. And in my sense, that is God, you know, everything that he has done for us and all. And it's kind of the same way with him. Somebody said, well, do you believe in aliens? No, I don't believe in aliens. I believe there's a God. But I believe that there could be aliens or something from other worlds. Or I said, you'd have to be foolish to go. You walk outside on a clear night and look up, look at the stars, and all these stars probably have planets around them. You'd have to be foolish. It's not other life out there.
And do you believe that God created them and us?
I do. Every religion on earth has their own God or the same God. Everybody needs something to believe in. And we just happen to believe in my household that in Jesus and God in that form. Every Bible that you got written has something to believe in. And, you know, so it's just hard to say who's right or who's wrong, but I know what I believe.
Okay, so here you are in the middle of all the publicity for the book, and this is part of that. Do you feel any differently about the whole experience? It was something that you wanted to put behind you. I mean, God, you can't even read part of the transcripts. You don't want to go there. Are you feeling any calmer about it in yourself, or do you still feel the same?
No, actually, I try to convince myself that it's easier and I do feel a little calmer and all, but it's all about the same. You know, there's times that it's fine and, you know, everything's okay. But my whole life has changed again. This event has changed my life several different times, you know. I come from a country boy, a hardworking, wanting just to have a job, to buy a house, in a car and pay for it all my life, to going out and having to take several different jobs and working like that and hiding from the press. Now I'm back to being part of the looking for the press, I guess, or not looking, but answering to the press where I wasn't before and not avoiding them. So, my life has been like a yo-yo. It's up and down. Who knows what's going to come out of it?
Understood. Do you fear, in the dead of the night when you're thinking, that they might come back for you sometime?
Nah, I'm too old to think about that now. You get a certain age and you don't worry about dying, you don't worry about living, you don't worry about nothing. And that's where I am at the stage of my life. That's like I told somebody the other day, it's an expiration date on your head. And the older you get, the more you realize that. So I guess I could say I really don't care if they come back or not. It's like this book. And somebody said, well, does it bother you that some people don't believe you? I said, no, I don't care if they believe it or not. I said, the book is pretty well documented. If it went to a court of law, it would stand up in a court of law because you have eyewitness testimonies, you have polygraphs, you have voice stress tests, you have a little bit of everything to prove a point. And I said, in the Bible, it says where two witnesses come together. There's been people executed over that. So, the book pretty well would stand up in a court of law.
And you say that it speaks for itself. I've discovered doing this, and anybody who speaks about anything or does anything realizes that there are some people, not many of them, but there are some people, and they're vocal now in this world because they've got social media and everything else, who delight in reading bad intentions into people's good motives. That's just one of those things. And you must have heard from people, I guess, who claim that you're making it all up or you're crazy or you're whatever. I'm wondering how you ride that out.
Yeah, and my response to them, I don't care. Buy the book, read it, convince yourself. Or not convince yourself. Because you're going to have people that really believe that you couldn't convince them that it's not. To some, it's open-minded. And to ones that will never believe. And that's the closed-minded people that will never believe, So, but it don't matter to me if they believe me or not.
Hmm. Anything we haven't said we should have?
Not that I could think of.
Okay, Calvin. I've enjoyed this conversation, and I'm glad we finally got to do it. I know you're busy doing interviews with various people now, and I wish you well with the book, and I'm glad that you teamed up with Philip Mantle. There is nobody better. And I wish you and your wife and your daughter well.
Thank you very much, and I've enjoyed it also.
Well, I'm going to remember that name, Pascagoula. It's going to be burned into my consciousness, and the book, I think, will be a very, very interesting read. It is published by Flying Disc Press, but I'll put a link to Calvin Parker and the book on my website, theunexplained.tv. If you want to tell me what you think about that or anything, go to my website, theunexplained.tv. It is the official home of The Unexplained with me, Howard Hughes. More great guests in the pipeline here, so until next we meet here on The Unexplained, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London the last time I checked, and please stay safe. Please stay calm. And above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.